Well, here we go again with another edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. It's March 9th, 2025. If you happen to be listening to this on the netcast dates, netcast not a broadcast, we don't have a radio station. We have the memory of a radio station. We have records from a radio station. We have hopes. Well, I wouldn't call them hopes. But there's always the possibility of a radio station in the future or perhaps a podcast. What we've got now are these sort of archival flashbacks and with a few comments from the current scene in this particular edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. You're going to be going to hear the flashbacks from February 2nd, 1996 and February 5th, 1996. And I'll be talking about what is in those flashbacks in more detail at the end of this introduction. But you should remember that these flashbacks were recorded in better straits, generally, although these were the early days of free radio, when we had a lot of participation, though, and that was a wonderful thing. But on the other hand, our technical problems were always there, too, and you can, in fact, hear techies calling into the show talking about why aren't we talking about working on the radio station instead of raising political issues at such as, you know, who's getting tried for medical marijuana and what homeless people are being run off, what property and so forth. Of course, that's the subject that my show usually covers and did continue to cover throughout my reign or my presence on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and even when it was no longer radio but simply a netcast, I've been continuing to do that. To some extent, trying to cover current events less successfully in more recent times, partially because of weariness, tiring, motivation, and lack of, frankly, support and input from folks who are listening or who may be listening to the station. I've actually continued to ask folks to let me know what they think, give me some feedback. And indeed, even though you can't call any of the numbers that are mentioned in the flashback to get directly on the air or into the actual program, if you call the Huff line, 831-423-4833 or 423-HUFF, you can reach me. I can and will get back to you or try to. Though I am moving to a cell phone, believe it or not, from a landline. I've had a landline for 30 years. I've decided time to go cellular. I'm not quite sure why I'm doing this. I'm told it's more convenient, that it's cheaper, it's more mobile, it makes more sense. I think it's got its drawbacks too, but I'm doing it. So you can call in for anything you want to contest. If you think there's something not being covered regarding homeless and local civil rights here in Santa Cruz, please do. 831-423-4833. And in the meantime, here's a familiar tune for you.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So if you go on Facebook and look up Reggie Meisler, M-E-I-S-L-E-R, you'll find some interesting clips and cuts and thoughts. Here's a story I found. He's an activist who's sued the city to try to stop the essentially criminalization of people in their RVs and vehicles who are parked along the streets in the coastal zone. I was successful doing that years ago, but the city has continued to push back to essentially exclude RVs from the city, as many other cities are doing, without providing any alternate lodging or accommodations that are really successful or helpful for the majority of folks who either live in their vehicles or rely on them to a great extent while they're trying to maintain a job. I guess live in the vehicle is the proper way of putting it. Anyway, here's a story that Reggie posted. Santa Cruz to start sweeping parking restrictions. Delaware Avenue is one of 12 streets in Santa Cruz and will be part of a street sweeping program starting March 4th. City staff are set to ticket starting March 4th or tow vehicles that violate the restrictions. Staff plan to street sweep parts of Coral Street, Harvey West Boulevard, Dubois Street, and Encinal Street in the Harvey West, Ocean Street, Soquel Avenue, and Water Street in Midtown, Delaware Avenue, Swanton Boulevard, Mission Street Extension, and Natural Bridges Drive on the west side. Street sweeping areas are marked with signs. There's a full map and schedule if you go on to the city's website. And let me do that. Maybe I could get you more information. But first, Reggie's comment on that story is, so that's Housing Matters, I call it Funding Matters, campus area at Highway 1 and Highway 9, also at the far west side and the Midtown near supermarkets. And the photos tell the whole story. What the photos show, if you look at the story on his website or on the Facebook page that he writes on, is a series of vehicles essentially parked one after another, many of them sort of look like vehicles people may be living in. They ain't tourist vehicles, apparently. They're older cars, and it's a little hard to judge the age of the car from the picture, but Reggie's interpretation is this was never about keeping the streets clean. It was always about pushing poor people around and stealing their vehicle shelter. Richard Martin then comments on Reggie's article, nobody is asking the right questions since both the River Street Shelter and the Page Smith Home Park have been eliminated, a mobile home park. Where are these functional programs' funding gone? The fact that the big commercial kitchen is non-functional, subcontracted Meals on Wheels, are all these not what the shelter no longer provides? Where are the funds going? He's talking about the Coral Street Poverty Industrial Complex there. Pat Colby replies, good question. In our email to get me emergency housing for the county, allowing their clients from Front Street Housing clients to do domestic violence, harassment, lies to fraudulently evict me and claims I was harassing them with violence when I have objective evidence to prove the opposite. We have been pushing hard on the question of where did all the mental health funding that was supposed to build low-barrier housing go? Where are these housing units? They violated the Violence Against Women Act, VAWA, which I'm not familiar with, which HUD provided for victims of domestic violence to protect from eviction and being forced into homelessness. It should be get interesting when our complaint with all my evidence hits them for fair housing, ADA, and VAWA rights violations with thousands of pieces of objective evidence. And certainly I wish her well with that. I haven't seen her evidence. I haven't seen the case. I know that Pat and her brother John frequently put their confidence and their energy into legal avenues, though Pat has also been quite prominent in speaking up publicly about it on a local level, whether the issue is harassing recyclers or harassing homeless people generally or harassing poor people who are forced into substandard and oppressive housing, such as that reportedly run by the John Stewart Company. And her claims are sometimes, they make me nervous because they don't seem often entirely supported by evidence. But again, how do you cram all the evidence into a small paragraph or two, which is hard to do. But her conclusions are very intense. She says, first go after Front Street housing and those who colluded with, she names some people, they all committed perjury, lied to judges and police officers. Then depending on what county files, it doesn't do now that federal level DHSS, SAMHSA, and their state liaisons contacted them giving programs. They could seek funds to give me the emergency housing, much needed housing, in a motel room due to respiratory physical disabilities, conduction, type 2 diabetes, UBS, fibromyalgia, ADHD, anxiety, return of my severe depression, other mood disorder, all things take housing to manage and control. Also, the constant danger and threats from the Take Back Santa Cruz, TBSC, continued vehicle stalking along with TBSC SCPD, now stalking me, a 64-year-old severely disabled lone woman who was allowed to be traumatized for 3 years and supposedly supported shared mental health housing that is safe, healthy, smoke-free, abuse-free. I need to find a different, honest agency that hasn't acted in malice and intent to do me harm and leave me to die so I can't hold them accountable once I'm dead, I guess he's saying, for their part failing to do their job as they describe in their mission statement. Instead, they colluded with dirty staff at Front Street Housing and allowed their delusional, dangerous clients to do violence and threaten my life in several different ways. Reggie has a second article here about an upcoming Housing Matters event. Again, this is the Funding Matters group that there has been the subject of some protests over the last year by Food Not Bombs, People's Aid, and HUF, actually, group I work with. We were concerned about the failure of Housing Matters and actually its collusion with the upper management's collusion with the police in sweeping away people in front of the Coral Street complex on Coral Street, who were essentially out there in their tents because they couldn't get housing elsewhere in other places. And, of course, this is the perennial situation in Santa Cruz. Massive amounts of money get kind of dumped in these nonprofits that often, though the volunteers or the workers there are quite sincere and quite concerned, the actual management and the way it's being done, instead of diverting funds to emergency support for people who are outside in their tents and houses, you have this fiction of a pathway to housing, which I continue to disparage as a form of fantasy and an excuse for getting money, and also an excuse, a pretense that you're doing something when you're not doing something, so that not just that you can get money, but you can. It's a way of sort of vanity signaling, or virtue signaling, I guess is the word I'm looking for. Also is a form of vanity too, I suppose. Anyway, what Reggie Meiser writes about their upcoming an event that Housing Matters is throwing: while this event does promote a positive message of humanization, it also ignores the systematic complicity and stubborn refusal of Housing Matters to hold itself accountable for how their ongoing behavior of working alongside police to displace people off Coral Street and throw away tents and survival gear contributes to potentially lethal harms to our local unhoused community, and actual harms, I would say. In 2022, our county's deputy health officer discovered a correlation between sweeps and overdose deaths. In 2023, a nationwide study released that looked at the impact of involuntary displacement on health outcomes over a 10-year period, and its findings echoed those of our county. The data is clear, Reggie continues, camp sweeps kill, and yet Housing Matters continues to utilize regular camp sweeps in front of their own campus. We cannot allow a city org that receives most of the funding for homeless services continue to aid and abet our local government in enacting genocidal harm to our unhoused community. We ask that our friends and allies who are speaking, please use your platform to help advocate to stop the sweeps and demand that Housing Matters hold this line, as well as by no means requesting or cooperating with law enforcement or city officials. And the event that's being presented is on March 30th that he's talking about. It's called Picture This, Cultivating Our Compassionate Community, Sunday, March 30th at 5 to 7:30 p.m. It's not clear exactly where this event is, but there are lots of, they list the presenters, they have the Speakers Bureau at Housing Matters, China Clark and Chris Field. They have presenters, Bella Bonner, founder of Black Surf, Gina Castaneda, Deputy, Santa Cruz County Deputy Probation Officer, Tenza Chokye, I hope I got that right, Tenzin, not sure if I do, I don't think I do, Buddhist teacher and compassion educator, Maria Elena de la Garza, CEO, Community Action Board, Edward Estrada, anyway, a whole bunch of, Curtis Rolliford is even a founder of Follow Your Heart Action. Shame on you, Curtis, for being a part of this crap, but that's my reaction. Heather Rogers, public defender of Santa Cruz County. I heard her speak at a prior Housing Matters event that we actually went to protest when they held it in the public library in Capitola some months ago. The guy who was sort of colluding with the sweeps, the head of the Housing Matters group, Phil Kramer, didn't even want to show his puss there. He was scheduled to speak, but he apparently thought better of it, or maybe, who knows, maybe he got sick. Maybe he suddenly decided to go out and start providing tents to people who are on the streets that his police had driven away to other places. I say his police, I mean police that he thanked later for doing a great job of clearing the street. I'm not quoting him exactly, but that seemed to be the gist of the email that he wrote. I'd like to see, it's actually here on this story, but it's in such small print that I can't read it. I've seen it before. So in any case, there's that event coming up on the 30th, and there are more complaints. Richard Martin again speaks, all this talk about audit, whoa, where did the funds go? Warning homeless shelter, taking all that money, zero feeding program. I'm sending a letter to the president with great concern about the low impact with high profits. No winter program, the tearing down of two functional care centers, the original shelter, the River Street shelter, and Paige Smith, the Rivers is how he describes that shelter. Never heard it described that way. Mobile homes, not even a 10-year life. My biggest concern is that the storage sheds put in place of these functional programs. Less overhead is, so where do the funds grow? In other words, they have these little wooden shacks that people get to get under. They aren't heated, they aren't insulated, I think they have, they may have one window, I'm not sure. They don't get very good response or report from the people. I'm thinking of one particular individual who's stayed in them at some length over the years and been a regular Huff attender. He's currently about to put out or has been working on a sort of a real guide for real free services. We're calling it Thomas's Tips, if it ever gets out, and it would be great if it does. Anyway, continuing with Richard Martin's critique of the Coral Street complex, a non-functional commercial kitchen, big, huge, quick freeze, subcontract the feeding program to Meals on Wheels. There are some serious questions about where are the funds going since they no longer have these programs. Where are the funds going now? Buying all these properties, but not much of an impact. So the people they're supposed to assist, again, not much impact. Alicia Cool writes, thank you. And Laura Chatham writes, much better to see how we can defund or detask the police and redirect the funds to our community. We won't need Housing Matters if we fund our community. And the film director, guess this was about a week ago, there was a film called Reimagining Safety, or Reimagining Safety, a free film at the Resource Center for nonviolence, which, by the way, is also, I am told, banned an anti-war activist and writer who's also a libertarian. Perhaps that's the reason they banned him. I think they regard libertarians as too far to the right. But in my sense, when you're trying to fight against an illegal and murderous war, as it's going on in the Ukraine and also in Gaza, take the allies you can get. Worry about your disagreements on other issues later. If you agree on that issue, stand together on that issue. That apparently is not the position of the Resource Center for Nonviolence, at least according to the communication I got from Joe Williams. I've had further conversations, perhaps I will, and maybe I can get a clarification. I've asked for him to come online for an interview, but he's so far said he's too busy. I hope he can get less busy. I don't know what kind of responsibility he has for this kind of decision. I don't think he's made it, but he is communicating it, and he does seem to be backing it, and it would be useful to have a discussion about what that's about. This is about a book by Scott Horton, which is called Provoked, which documents the narrative that Russia's Putin and the government that presumably also shares some of Putin's sentiments decided to invade Ukraine in response to the encroachments of NATO and the refusal of Ukraine to stop attacking its domestic Russian-speaking population in the Donbas and the Luhansk provinces. And that is something that has generally not been reported much about in establishment press media that I've seen. So in any case, you can get some discussion on Reggie Meisler's Facebook page of some homeless issues. It's easier to find it than on establishment media, for sure. And so let's take a musical break. So this is a song, another in the series of A History of the World, according to David Rovics, a sort of musical history of the world, and very passionately and I think effectively, although leftishly, presented by David Rovics. This is called Vanunu, and it's about the exposure of Israel's secret nuclear arsenal and the abduction of Mordecai Vanunu.
A History of the World, according to David Rovics. History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. Mark Twain was long known to have an arsenal of nuclear weapons. There has been speculation around how Israel first got a hold of the bomb-grade plutonium they needed in order to manufacture them, and whether the deaths of JFK and or Karen Silkwood might be related to this process. What was no longer of any doubt by 1986 was that Israel's secret nuclear arsenal existed because of the heroic actions of whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu, before he was kidnapped off the streets of Rome by Mossad and brought back to Israel to spend decades in prison. I was born in Marrakesh, and I thought life was good. Then some visitors came from far away, convinced us that we should move from Marrakesh to Israel, what they called the Promised Land. That's how we ended up in Beersheba, by the Negev desert sand. I turned 18 and joined the army, that's what everybody did. I learned to blow up bridges, just like every other kid. I learned to fire weapons, I learned how to shoot to kill. Then I studied engineering and learned many other skills. I got a job, paid the rent, working just like you. I just did what I had to do.
years went by. I learned many things, and I wondered what to do with the burden knowledge brings. I learned about the massacres committed in my name. After Sabra and Shatila, life could never be the same. But I got up every morning, worked till the day was through, and I did what I had to do. Working in the desert, I did what I was told, though I'd long ago rejected the bill of goods I had been sold. I was supposed to ask no questions, but as the years passed by, I discovered what was going on there beneath the clear blue sky. I snuck a camera into work one day as my suspicions grew, and I did what I had to do. Once I left the country, I could no longer sit on the fence. I met with a reporter and displayed the evidence of the secret nuclear arsenal which I had helped to make. I had to blow the whistle for humanity's sake. The world simply had to find out the things my commanders knew. So I did what I had to do. Mossad came to get me on the streets of Rome, brought me in a boat back to my adopted home. After 18 years of torture in a tiny prison cell, on the street some people ask me how I lived so long in hell. Each morning when I woke up, I remembered it was true that I did what I had to do. I did what I had to do.
So here's a bit more about the street sweeping program that I mentioned to you earlier that began March 4th, according to Reggie Meisler's story from Santa Cruz Local. Here's another, maybe in its extended part of the Santa Cruz Local story, looks like it. Parking in the areas during the street sweeping hours could incur, according to this, a warning for the first violation, $48 for the second, $96 for the third, and $144 for each additional violation. The article continues, and on Santa Cruz Local, city staff may tow some vehicles, quote, as a last resort, unquote, in emergencies or ahead of storms, according to a staff report published in 2024. The city cannot tow vehicles for unpaid parking tickets without a court order. The street sweeping program targets areas that a report found to have more trash than the rest of city streets. By moving cars and allowing street sweepers against curbs, the program aims to clear trash that could wash down city storm drains into creeks, the San Lorenzo River, and the Monterey Bay. For more information, see a street sweeping map and schedule on the city's website, or contact the City Department of Public Works at citypw@santacruzcal.gov, or call them up. And there are other articles, but I guess Reggie seems to have a rather strong suspicion that this is because of where the program is located, around congregations of homeless vehicles. It's concerned with not really cleaning things up, which could be done in other ways, or more reasonably than going in to sweep people up, since the no parking hours are from 5 to 7 a.m. on certain weekdays, though they do, they say, mark it with signs. And again, the areas are the Coral Street, Harvey West Boulevard, Du Bois, and Encinal Street in Harvey West, Ocean Street, Soquel, and Water in Midtown, and Delaware, Swanton Boulevard, Mission, and Mission Street Extension, Natural Bridges Drive on the west side. And here's a story from Santa Cruz Indie Media, which I've had not enough connection with lately. I've been intending to post some information about the protest that we did against Funding Matters, Housing Matters, as they call themselves, when they did their Rio Theater Poverty Pimpery, $13 to get in to watch a movie, which was well attended, and also attended by some of us outside in the rain protesting, and which you can hear online on this website. If you go to the HuffSantaCruz.org website, you'll get, I guess it's a show two or three Sundays back. I audioed most of the protest, and also you can find it on John Doe 13K YouTube channel. Again, you go to YouTube, then you write in the word John, and then the second word Doe 13K, all one words, Doe 13K, and you can go directly to Wes White's video, or videos, where he covers a lot of public events in Monterey County. Too much of the political horseshit, as far as I'm concerned, which you continue to see him and other homeless people appealing for compassion, mercy, and sanity to the authorities, the political authorities, who don't seem to be listening, but at least he has pointed out the voices get to the public as well in some form, particularly through his videos. So, anyway, this is Santa Cruz Indie Media, which I said before, has a story, ACLU challenges unconstitutional seizure of UCSC's student phone by the ACLU of Southern California. And this has to do, of course, with the crackdown on pro-Palestinian sentiment and the attacks that the, not just the Trump administration, but Democrats as well under Biden and Congress, of course, and rich donors are pressing in a kind of a pro-Zionist way to silence any criticism of the ongoing genocide in Gaza, which is due to begin again any day now, which is actually continuing in spite of the ceasefire, at least according to reports that have not really been contradicted by Israeli sources. In fact, I think they have been confirmed by Haaretz, the main Israeli paper, although allegedly for liberal Zionists. Anyway, this story is about the, well, I'll read it, the ACLU Foundation of Northern California, Center for Protest, Law and Litigation, and civil rights attorney Thomas Sebau filed a motion on March 5th to challenge an unconstitutionally broad search warrant that authorized UCSC police to seize and search a student's cell phone in violation of California Electronics Communication Privacy Act, First and Fourth Amendments, and the California Constitution. And there's a copy of the lawsuit on this website. The student, who is a third-year undergraduate and a resident advisor, previously filed a lawsuit against UCSC after it banned her and others from campus for participating in a pro-Palestine anti-war protest in May 2024, which I think I attended, at least I went up to thank them for doing it or to see what was happening or to make a few comments and also get a few comments from the protesters. Probably that's, you may find some of that back in May and June and of the shows I was doing then. UCSC police sought and obtained a warrant to seize the student's phone just weeks after she had filed that lawsuit. Timing that raises serious questions about retaliation against the student's constitutionally protected First Amendment rights. The warrant gives UCSC police access to years of private communications, location data, and personal photos without reasonable limits on time or scope. Quote, the Fourth Amendment and California law both demand that digital search warrants be narrowly tailored to specific time periods and types of information, said ACLU attorney Chessie Thatcher. But this warrant gives officers permission to sift through extremely private information that predated the student's time at UCSC by years, when the government can look through someone's photos and internet searches dating back to when they were a fifth grader to find something that might have happened in college, we have a constitutional problem. The warrant also permitted campus police to search through privileged communications between the student and her attorneys about the very litigation that she had brought against the school for police misconduct. When officers can seize phones and read through attorney-client communications about an active civil rights case, it creates a chilling effect that undermines access to justice, said Rachel Letterman, senior counsel with the Center for Protest Law and Litigation. When police seize a student's phone while she is outside in her pajamas for a fire drill, in view of numerous other students, we cannot help but think they are trying to intimidate her and other students from engaging in pro-Palestine protest on campus. These days, your whole life is on your phone, the places you've been, the websites you've visited, the details of your closest relationships. It can also include expressions of political dissent, criticisms of your employer, and the identities of the people whose beliefs you share, said Thomas Sebau. It is horrifying to think about the authorities coming after all that information just because you dared to exercise your right to challenge their illegal actions in court. This motion we are filing has profound implications for the democratic rights of students, protesters, and dissenters throughout the country, especially at this moment in history. The motion asks the court to quash the warrant, order the immediate return of the phone to the student, and require the destruction of any data already obtained through this unlawful search. So there's also some good news from Bernard College. The long silent voices of protest on campuses across the country, probably not entirely silent, mostly silenced by media blackout, but I haven't heard much of protests either here or in locally at the UCSC or Cabrillo around the Gaza genocide, though, as I mentioned earlier, the reports that I've been reading indicate that Israeli IDF forces continue to violate the ceasefire agreement. Now there's a siege for all food and medicine declared by Netanyahu, wants to force Palestinians to agree to the everybody out of Gaza. Or actually, it's I guess it's initially all Hamas out of Gaza. In other words, not having been able to win militarily, they expect to win by starving the population, which they were doing beforehand, the Israeli government and the Israeli IDF. Anyway, there hasn't been much protest against it that I've seen visibly, but Bernard apparently began to push back. I'm reading the establishment media account from Eyewitness News, so bear that in mind. I'm not going to play the verbal account, which I would have to stop and make what I think are essential corrections or additions or comments on. But I will read what they wrote about it. This is WABC. A sit-in protest at Bernard College lasted several hours Wednesday night as demonstrators demanded the reinstatement of two students expelled for distributing flyers against inside a Columbia University lecture, organizers said. The protest erupted on the Upper Manhattan campus as demonstrators forcibly entered a campus building. It's not quite clear what that means. I mean, normally buildings are open to students on campus. Was it during non-business hours? It's possible. Did it simply the employees decided they just wanted to close the building because they were afraid of a protest? Don't know. So we can't really tell. That forcibly entered is an example of wording that tends to say portray protesters as violent, dangerous, appropriate to repress, and so forth. Assaulting a school employee in the process. Again, I would wonder what the assault involved. But no more details I've seen yet provided in the few stories I've read. Approximately 60 protesters stormed Milbank Hall, bringing food and supplies in preparation for an extended sit-in. Congressman Richard Torres posted video of the incident on X, calling it an aggressive mob. Mm-hmm. You might call him an aggressive congressman who wants to, I don't know. I don't know much about Richie Torres, but he's right to his opinion. And he talks about, on X, he talks about an aggressive mob has taken over a building at Columbia University, that's right next to Bernard, demanding Intifada Revolution, which is a call to violence against the Jewish state, or simply perhaps to resistance to the Jewish occupation, siege, oppression, bombing, and genocidal murder of people in Gaza. If you want to sort of shift that around and make it appear to be Israeli self-defense, I don't agree with you. Is Columbia University going to stand by and allow an aggressive mob to engage in a hostile takeover of its property? Well, are they students? In what way are they taking it over? And again, I guess I would say, you know, even if I abandoned, you know, trying to sort of nitpick their language, I'm looking for more details here. And create a hostile environment for its Jewish students. I would say it's probably an unpleasant environment in some respects for Zionist supporters, whether they're Jewish, Christian nationalist, neocon supporters, whoever they are, because, you know, it may be stimulating to be able to have a real debate. But the fact is, a hostile environment is a nice way of describing if you're somehow arguing against a genocide in your own country, or people you have relatives in that country who's, you know, where they live, then you're somehow creating a hostile environment by raising the issue when it's U.S. funds that are, of course, supplying the significant portion of the bombs and the armaments, and of course, without whose okay would never go on, as we saw then. Trump snapped his fingers, Netanyahu barked or jumped. A university that fails, and did the ceasefire, though he wasn't going to do it. A university that fails to hold violent agitators accountable, it's always nice to call them violent if you want to repress them, and this is what was done frequently in the 60s. But admittedly, you got to be honest about what actually is going on, and I haven't heard a lot of clear reports. It's really hard because the media isn't covering it. Accountable. University that fails to hold violent agitators accountable should be itself held accountable. In other words, this guy is going to be supporting a cutoff of funding to these universities because, I say that because that in fact is what has happened recently. At least that's what Trump announced he was doing. And let me see. So back to the story from Eyewitness News from dated March 7th. Morningside Heights. Four Columbia students have been suspended and banned from campus after taking part in the pro-Palestinian protest at Bernard's College Milstein Library on Wednesday. Columbia confirmed that students were removed from the campus and arrested this week as a part of this week's disruption at Bernard College. These students have been suspended and restricted from campus as we swiftly work through the discipline process, Columbia University said in a statement. We are a campus community governed by our rules, policies, and the law. Any violations of these will not be tolerated and will have consequences. And that's interesting, of course, depends on the nature of these rules and policies and the law, who has created them under what pressure, and how they restrict fundamental rights and liberties that students need to have to raise issues that the broader community doesn't want to even think about or is muffled from discussing because of special interest groups and special interest money. The students were part of a group protesting Bernard College's decision to expel two students who they say invaded a modern Israeli history class handing out flyers containing anti-Emetic imagery, whatever that is. The protesters demanded the expelled students' reinstatement. So this is pushback against the, we're going to kick you all out and intimidate you all if you don't shut up about the genocide in Gaza. During the protest, college officials pleaded with protesters to talk, but were drowned out by masked, anonymous demonstrators. But what, of course, what is not being discussed in this paper are what the actual demands were other than reinstatement, or why these, why were the students expelled? What are the issues the students are trying to raise about the university's complicity with the genocide over in Gaza? This doesn't appear in this story at all, of course. College president also tried to speak with the protesters on the phone, but the call went nowhere. Pro-Palestinian protests also broke out Thursday at Columbus and Bernard, but remained calm. The disciplinary process for this 4 students suspended and banned campus due to Wednesday's protest is proceeding. So all is normal. No cause to pause here. No cause for alarm. Well, I'm glad to see that the original protests that began at Columbia University last year, who knows? Maybe something similar is happening again. I sure hope so. However, now it's time for a little musical relief. David Rovick's going to tell us in song about the anti-highway movement and victory in Massachusetts in a song titled A Brief History of the Orange Line.
Throughout the period they call modernity, there have been its discontents. In some places, you might say the discontents were in power. In Copenhagen, for example, it seems pretty evident that bicyclists have been running the place and building the city's infrastructure for quite some time now. From the 1950s and for decades afterwards, building and expanding the highways of America continued. From the beginning of the highway building project, poor and especially black neighborhoods were disproportionately targeted for having the highway cut the neighborhood in half. This was slated to befall the neighborhoods of Roxbury and Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts as well, and would have been their fate if not for the anti-highway movement. The movement to stop the highways lost a lot of battles, but it won a lot of them too. A decisive victory was the expansion of the Orange Line in Boston, Massachusetts, which opened for public use in 1987. Protests against the expanding highway had begun much earlier, as had the Massachusetts Department of Transportation's highway building plan. In fact, the land had already been purchased, and the building of the highway had already begun by the time hundreds of people committed civil disobedience and began to turn the tide in the direction of a better train system instead of more interstate. At the Jackson Square T-stop, you can today find a plaque in appreciation of those stopped the highway. In the 60s, they were building lots of single-family homes. The suburbs were the place to have your child, dog, and cat. Businessmen, housewives, each had a swimming pool, prescription drugs, a big car, and a generic welcome mat. All the suburbs needed highways. They were being built in every state, from the East Coast to the West. But when in Boston, Massachusetts, they came to build a highway at GM and DOT's behest, in front of their bulldozers, there in Jamaica Plain, from all around, people came and stood. They asked, should we have commuters or community, a highway or a neighborhood? The governor said, we hear you, but you just don't understand. It's the way things are, the order of the day is that progress must go on, the economy must grow, and this state needs another highway. A whole bunch of people protested, a whole bunch were arrested. The cops figured that was that. But folks kept coming back where the backhoes were supposed to dig. That's just where people sat. They asked, would you have a fast lane here with big trucks spewing diesel, or keep your homes of wood? Would you have commuters or community, a highway or a neighborhood?
It was the anti-highway movement who said the national is local. And the people of JP, against all those in power, the biggest business interests, federal as well as state authority. But perseverance won, and the highway was abandoned. The neighborhood remains. Instead, they built a subway line, a long, thin park, playgrounds, and bicycle lanes. The people had spoken. The question had been answered, as one would think it should. Should we have commuters or community, a highway or a neighborhood? Should we have commuters or community, a highway or a neighborhood?
And here's a story to, well, could upset you if you're of that frame of mind. Bakersfield, California. Bakersfield PD, city crews, clear out homeless encampments by Kern River in joint operation by Connor Dorr, February 19, 2025. It's a couple weeks back. Dozens of Bakersfield police officers cleared homeless encampments along the Kern River Wednesday morning. By that, of course, they mean they destroyed homeless shelter and lodging without providing them alternatives. They seized homeless survival gear, making them vulnerable to the elements. They actually endangered life as part of their plan to eliminate the visible homeless by essentially making life unlivable for them there. It was a joint operation with city crews in trucks, cars, and even officers on horseback. The department said 24 encampments were cleared and 23 people were arrested. Others were offered shelter, some went, and some declined. 19 dogs were taken into custody. William Kindred, a homeless man, is 31 years old and a lifelong Bakersfield resident. He's been homeless off and on for 11 years. He said that flood ministries warned the people living there of the raid, and he was prepared. Some of us were prepared for, you know, like on it immediately. Others procrastinate a lot, so they weren't ready, Kindred said. I would like to add that when this happens in Santa Cruz, frequently the police will come and threaten to move you. Everybody will get ready to move, and then the police just don't show up. And so there are reasons why people have grown skeptical, because police would like to bluff you out, get you to move, get you to hide out, leave town, without any kind of paperwork necessarily being filled out or city expense being produced. Anyway, Kindred, back in Bakersfield, was out of the river by sunrise, but saw people he knew getting kicked out. He said the river is desirable for homeless people. That's probably the better place to be at, because you're not literally on the streets, you're not out in public and whatnot. But when you go out there and you see the trash, the camps and all that, a lot of people like to walk out there and take their dogs out there. And when they come up on a camp, they got dogs or something like that, and they get a little sketched out. So why not just demolish the camps and send the people into a refugee status? I guess that's the Bakersfield solution. So the New York Times does have a story about this. Maybe I'm only catching the abbreviated version. Pro-Palestinian activists occupy Bernard Building for the second time in a week, getting back to the Bernard protest against the Gaza genocide and against the expulsion of students for peacefully protesting it and then getting expelled for their trouble. The police department said several demonstrators were taken into custody during the sit-in at the college's main library. About 24 pro-Palestinian demonstrators at Bernard College in Manhattan occupied the lobby at the school's main library on Wednesday, escalating a confrontation with school administrators and leading to several protesters being taken into custody, the police said. Or perhaps you could put the first paragraph differently. Administrators, in refusing to respond to the just demands of students that those expelled for peaceful protesting last May be restored to their to the campus, that their housing be given back to them, and that they be given some compensation for the time, education, and damages that have occurred as a consequence. At least the loss of education, I guess the word would be. But that's not the paragraph. You heard me read the first paragraph by Sharon Otterman of the New York Times. Chanting Free Palestine and wearing masks and keffiyeh over their faces, the protesters began their sit-in inside the Milstein Center for Teaching and Learning. About 1 p.m., the school blocked access to the building shortly afterward, and classes were disrupted. So it appears that it may be the school itself disrupted the classes by blocking access to the building. It wasn't the protesters blocking access, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I, of course, am sympathetic to the protesters, but I would still ask these questions and suggest any reasonable person would do the same, regardless of your position on the Israeli-Gaza conflict. The protests came at a moment when pro-Palestinian activism on college campuses is a subject of intense interest to the Trump regime. They call it the Trump administration. In executive orders, President Trump, I call him Führer Trump, as I would have called Biden, Führer Biden, perhaps war criminals, both, but anyway, he has threatened to revoke federal funding to universities that allow what he and his administration regard as anti-Semitic activity. And he's made it clear that pro-Palestinian protests, particularly those that appear to support Hamas, can qualify as such in his view. It's interesting that they're being a little more circumspect about not immediately just simply swallowing the it's anti-Semitic, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic hook, line, and sinker, which it isn't, of course. There are plenty of Jewish folks who oppose Zionist behavior in Israel, both recently in Gaza and perhaps throughout the history of Israel. Or at least more recently for sure. Hours after the protest began on Wednesday afternoon, the situation remained fluid as police department vans and officers with zip ties began gathering near Bernard's campus on 116th Street and Broadway. Ooh boy, maybe we can catch some of these protesters. Shortly afterward, Bernard administrators announced to protesters they had received a bomb threat, and police and security began evacuating the building. The protesters initially decided to remain, chanting over the sound of alarms, according to a witness and social media reports. At 5 p.m., police department officers walked through the lobby, inspecting the building as chanting continued, according to a video shot on site. About 10 minutes later, police began pushing the protesters out of the building. As police became more aggressive, there appeared to be resistance from some protesters. Police responded by taking at least several students into custody and placing their wrists in zip ties. By 5:20 p.m., all the protesters appeared to have been removed from the building. Those not detained were permitted to leave the campus. I don't know if they're saying it in this story, but an earlier story that I read a few days ago said that protesters pointed out subsequently that they were directed back into the building by the police, not out of the building. And if there had been a real bomb threat, the police would not have been doing that. They suspected it was an attempt to thwart a protest and to evacuate the building with a pretext. Continuing the story in the New York Times, according to a police department spokesman, the police received a 9/11 call about a bomb threat to the building at 4:22 p.m. Officers responded to clear the building, and those who resisted police orders were taken into custody. So stop your protesting or we'll arrest you, in other words. Charges were still pending as of Wednesday evening. Columbia and Bernard, its affiliated women's college, are already under scrutiny for their students' pro-Palestinian activism, and hopefully under scrutiny for the rest of us for their crackdown on student behavior, basically First Amendment speech, and also the attempt of a militant and conscience group of individuals to stand up and denounce U.S. involvement and U.S. support of the Gaza genocide that continues. On Monday, the Trump administration announced a comprehensive review of Columbia University's federal contracts and grants, and three investigations into allegations of anti-Semitism at Columbia are underway. By all means, investigate. By cracky. The protesters who gathered on Wednesday were demanding the reversal of the expulsions of two Bernard students who were punished for interrupting a History of Modern Israel class on January 21st and distributing flyers, including one that showed a jackboot squashing a Jewish star. They also called for the reinstatement of a student expelled for participating in the takeover of Hamilton Hall on the Columbia's campus last spring, according to Columbia University Apartheid Divest, a student protest group. This is the second such sit-in to take place in Bernard over the issue. A week ago, dozens of pro-Palestinian demonstrators staged a sit-in at Milbank Hall. According to the Bernard administration, those protesters injured a security officer when they pushed into a building and graffitied the walls, causing about $30,000 of damage. He became so upset by looking at the graffiti that he created damage not very specific about the damage. That sit-in ended without arrests after 7 hours, and protesters were promised in writing on Bernard letterhead that they would not face disciplinary action for their presence in the building if they left by 10:30 p.m. But on Monday, President Laura Rosenberry of Bernard appeared to counter that. Say, whoops, sorry about that. Published an opinion piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education that said that Bernard would vigorously pursue discipline and other remedies against those who forcibly and illegitimately threaten our funding sources with our Zionist backers. I'm sorry, that's not what it says. It says, who forcibly and illegitimately entered our building, or the building, damaged or destroyed property, disregarding our community expectations and violating many policies and rules. And now a few voices from Food Not Bombs area that I visited on Saturday. That would be yesterday if you're listening to this on Sunday. You too can wander on down and talk to folks who are out there and, I don't know, just maybe get rid of some stereotypes you may have or they may have, and who knows. Anyway, here's a little something. We're talking with
Danger.
And Danger here at the town clock. It's about 20 to 3 on the 8th of March. Mm-hmm. And you were saying this is going to sound, how is this going to sound?
Rough, but last time I was here a year ago, you held a homeless coalition meetings and you encouraged us to brainstorm about what we think we need. And we all concluded on some edgy things, but basically a map of abandoned buildings for us to occupy just to get out of the elements. And all of that's terribly illegal, but I believe in that stuff. I'm like a Robin Hood. I'm sinfully perfect. I am the good guy, and this is a crime I'll gladly do for my people. I'm passionate about them. They die from the elements because they're drug addicts. So
even if they aren't drug addicts.
To bring it up, I'm developing an app for homeless about resources. And guess what? Abandoned buildings will be part of that app. So you may want to distance me because I'll be the developer of said app. But I don't care, man. Throw the cards up in the air and let them land where they may. Sometimes it's time to polarize. We need some rights. Santa Cruz is well off, but San Jose services are total shit, man. Those guys are just dying out there, literally.
Have you recently been over there?
Yeah, a girl OD'd from alcohol. That's hard to do, right? You know about alcohol poisoning.
Well,
your body tells you no, and
also
you throw
DTs.
So when you're at that condition, it's because you're hopeless of some sort. There's no AA meetings readily available. The water gives you dysentery. She soothes herself with pyromania. I mean, things are beautiful here. It's not what I'm talking about. I have a burning desire to help San Jose Batman, there's a guy who dresses up like that and gives out water and snacks to the homeless and connects them, the addicts, with a strange family. That's how I was found. And, you know, I'm an architect. I want to do something, you know, among the illegal, you know, like a moisture kite that collects dew somehow, because there's a lack of water in San Jose. Like, this is a paradise. Everyone here is hippie. There's a culture of weed. You know, we fight over our fucking ego. This is stupid stuff. It's like cute here in Santa Cruz. But elsewhere, people are just in total. They get MRSA because they're in the trash because they need to eat. I don't want to sound preachy, but...
Sound as you wish.
They break my heart, man. My people are suffering. I need help. I need design help. I need moral support. I need help to help them. I don't know what to say. I can't do it all. That's about it.
None can alone. No question.
That's all I got, I think.
And we've been talking with?
Danger. When would this cast? Because I'd like to listen to your other stuff, too.
Say that again.
When does your podcast...
It'll be tomorrow.
What's the name of it?
It's called Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And it's on the Huff...
Bathrobes, what?
Yeah, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Oh. Not like Robespierre, but Bathrobes,
Piers. Do you have a card? Because I'm fucking dyslexic and...
this is a card.
I'll blow at you.
he's a lover, not a fighter. He's a good man.
That's not on there, though.
He created...
Robert?
Red Zeppelin.
That's not on there, though. Can you write down the... Oh, there it is.
So, you published this?
No, but I distributed it. Yep, you have one if you want.
It's not a... Oh. It's on the radio? No, what's your podcast? Where is that on?
It's archived on the Huff website, and it's also netcast as well. It's on the net. It goes on at 9:30.
Oh, I got you. I got you. All right. No. Just being...
that's fine. That's
very
fine.
Observant. Okay,
no problem. If you want to reach me, you got to wait a couple of days because my phone's being changed, but...
I'm just saying, listen, Robert,
yeah, something like that.
Listen, well, you could be...
Cell phone.
Robin, listen to your name. Robin.
Robert.
I said that. I said that wrong. But if you were Robin, you could help Batman.
You can call me Robin.
You could help Batman, Robert.
Then I'd go Batty.
No, I got the spot for you. If you go over behind,
thank you.
If you go to Trader Joe's, right directly across the street is a archway. If you go in the archway about 10 feet, it's Echo Chamber. And I always go in there and go, quick, to the Batcave, Robin.
Indeed. And again, we have been talking with. For the interest of our listener,
Stephen Ross.
And Stephen, are you outside too or not?
I would say I was forced outside by a fire. I was living here for 5 years. I retired here. My company that I started in 1996 or whatever has been paying me a couple thousand bucks a month.
Right.
Well, it's been lower and lower and lower amounts. It's been zero for about 3 years. Because, you know,
charming.
The cat's the way the mice are playing. But they got the doors open.
Hey, Greg.
So since they're not really doing what I designed them to do, I'm not going to mention them here. Mm. But I'm the king of, the broker of, Discovery Home Loans, which has been a very successful brokerage for many, many years. They are not part of Discovery. They're part of another company that they've created using my licenses, which is legal. This is not. I just use a different name, like an alias. Their alias. So...
What have you found in Santa Cruz in the last couple of weeks that you think might be of use to people who either inside and looking out or outside and wanting to get in?
Well, I will tell you, first of all, this is Candyland. I'm not talking about drugs, alcohol, or nothing else. Along the San Lorenzo River that goes what you call the bridge of Lost Boys Bridge, next to the boardwalk, there's the San Lorenzo River. If you end up walking down the path on either side, one's the sidewalk, a road, Murray, and the other one is just the dirt. Well, it's got licorice growing, wild licorice. It's little yellow flowers about 3.5 feet tall. And when it starts to get mature, it turns black. And that's licorice. But the yellow licorice is way better. So you could walk along, eat some candy.
Have you been eating the plants recently?
Yes.
I see.
The ones that are away from the spray.
Mm-hmm. And have you paid the poor city fathers for those plants that you've eaten?
They grow natural.
So you're going to claim it's natural for you to take them, I suppose?
Well, the buddies can eat them.
Mm. But have you paid your taxes?
I'm exempt. I'm an outside person. I'm set free.
We would hope so.
I'm set free of the water bill, the power bill,
the rent bill.
The lovely city of Santa Cruz has a library, or county library, and they provide free charging stations, so the electricity is free. So I charge up my musical devices, the phone, the tablet, for the YouTube.
Just don't fall asleep in the library.
Yeah, they'll kick you out. So that's.
And don't hang out there at night, even though if it's a roof and it's raining.
That's be a bad idea because the police patrol it constantly.
And the security guards too.
They're only during operational hours.
Really, that's different, I guess, than it used to be.
Well, the police are right there.
Yeah.
And the police have asked me to move along because they did set up a tent there.
Well,
in the
you
back.
Do look very, very suspicious. I see you have your ID with you, though.
Well, the United States Marine Corps. This is my father's, though, 1954.
You're Korea. Imitating your father? Shameful.
No, okay. I'm carrying on his wishes.
I see. All right, fair enough.
Under his authority. He's in heaven, though.
Ah, well, I can't comment on that.
Because you might be going the other... No,
I'm going...
I know where you're going.
I don't know where I'm going, but I'm on my way, I'll tell you that.
The mayor here is a lovely man. His office is a block from the museum.
You mean Fastlane Fred Keeley?
Yeah.
One of my least favorite people, I got to tell you.
You got to know how to talk to him.
Oh, I mean, he's a nice guy, but as a politician, he stinks.
Oh, well, I'm a...
As far as homeless people.
I'm a 45-year real estate broker. 40-year real estate
broker. You're not a broker at the moment. That's
no,
the point.
I am licensed.
No, but that may be, but you're not selling property right now.
No, why bother? I mean, I don't...
Well, in other words, you're not profiteering off of other people's needs at the moment.
Or their misery. And they have a lot of vacant property here, and every week they got another one, because they keep raising the rents. I don't know what their plan is.
Make more money.
But you can't make money if you have vacant property.
Oh, well, I don't know. You can use it as an asset and make and more loans can
borrow
be done.
Money. You can borrow money on a vacant property, but at some point it comes to a tipping point, and when that happens, foreclosures go crazy.
Well.
And maybe that's going to be the next move. Thank you for chit-chatting with me.
And we have been talking with
Stephen Ross.
Thank you, Stephen.
Real estate broker, 45 years, extraordinaire.
Which I will not hold against you.
Well, you know, the millions of dollars that I were put in my bank account from hard work and labor and working Saturday and Sunday, it cost me some time with my family, so I've been married 3 times. The first one, I was not a millionaire. Second one, I was kind of tapping.
Heading toward there?
Oh, what?
Heading toward the millionaire?
Yeah. And then the third one, I was kind of in a... single stage for about 5 years, just working my ass off, and the congruency of what I was doing met with the market at the right time, as they say, and I was able to buy 4 properties for under $100,000, not here, but in the Stockton area. Then I fixed them up, put new roofs on them, did a bunch of work, rented them out, solid base, borrowed against them, and bought more property until I had 10. And I still wanted 2 more. But I would say it's very successful. I mean, to buy the property, fix up the property. And
I'm not going to hold that against you either.
And it makes it a better community when you have the homes looking nice. Have a lot of concrete.
Anybody can get in them, yeah, that's true. Well, anybody can afford them.
Well, I wasn't jacking the rents. I kept them low.
No, not you, but I'm talking about the general whole approach. Selling property for profit usually involves that kind of thing. There goes all those pages here. Let me gather up my merchandise and thank you.
You're a good man.
Hey.
What do they tell you about? Whatever they say about you is a lie. You're a good man.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And Fred is a wonderful man, too. The mayor and his staff so far have been
give him my regards when you see him.
Oh, you got it. In fact, I may even hand him one of his papers.
Oh, well, I'm sure he'll thank you with a smile.
He will, because he's a great guy.
Indeed. I would say because he's a great politician.
He's very efficient.
So, Greg B., as you're...
But before we get into Greg, here's a little more from David Rovics. So, continuing with Rovics as he wanders through the 1980s and 90s, here's his comments on the sanctions on Iraq and the deaths of 500,000 children there, according to UNICEF. This is a song for Basra.
The former head of the CIA, George H.W. Bush, was only president for one term, but it was quite a doozy. By the time he was done with the world, the government of Panama had been violently overthrown, and much of Iraq was turned into a radioactive wasteland, with untold thousands killed by explosives with American flags on them falling from the sky. Just next to Iran, the Iraqi city of Basra had been particularly devastated in the course of the Iran-Iraq War throughout most of the 1980s. During the U.S. war against Iraq, both Kurds in the Kurdish region and Shia in Basra were encouraged to rise up against Saddam Hussein, and then both were hung out to dry by the American imperialists. The UN sanctions further devastated Basra in particular throughout the 1990s, and Iraq generally, killing, according to UNICEF, 500,000 Iraqi children.
Where it is.
Sing a song for every bomb that flies. I'd sing each and all the days. If there were to be a verse for every dying child's cries, for every helpless father's gaze. If I could write a love letter for each corpse as it's carried, I'd never still my. If I had to stop a moment for each one as it's buried, I'd never move again. But the stocks are going up somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song for Basra. Shed a tear for every home that bombs destroy. I'd never stop crying. If each broken brick were a heart of a little girl or boy, all the world's children would be sighing. If I could hold each shattered body, each baby stilled at birth, I'd have no time for loneliness. I'd spend all my days embracing the people of this savaged earth, feeling the poisoned wind's caress. And the billionaires are laughing somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song for Basra. Were a woman's shiny eyes, I'd fall in love forever. If each bombed out kindergarten were a factory in disguise, wouldn't that be clever? But bricks are only bricks, and dust is only dust, and death is all around. Each day another missile falls, and sometimes the only thing to trust is the shaking of the ground. And they're loading up the war planes somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song.
Greg B., as you're sometimes known, what have you to tell us about current Santa Cruz scene here? If you can move a little closer, I'd love you even more.
Yeah. There's there's potential. People are feeling some of the... There's been a little bit of overpush against us, and some people are... So the sympathy meter, as Mayor Keeley calls it, which is a real thing. It's just, I mean, it's not a real thing, but it's a concept that the public does get tired of our impact upon...
Compassion fatigue.
Compassion fatigue, yeah. And so, but some of it, you know, they overpushed, and they're seeing how it's terrorizing us and sending us to the hospital, sending us to the...
morgue.
Mental ward, sending us to the morgue quite often, sending us to hopelessness when...
In front of cars.
Oh, yeah, that's a weird thing. How many people
suddenly show up in front of us?
Yeah, yeah.
Or you, I should say.
Same location. Not me personally, but my friend.
No, you being a member of a homeless, dare I say it, group.
I mean, it's absurd. But I know that, I mean, I wish they would put some traffic cameras up to record. I mean, if it's the most fatal and most accident-prone corner... For city's liability, say,
Highway 1 and Highway 9.
You know, Anthony Condotti ought to be looking at that as far as liability impact to the city, and at least getting something up there. Other than that,
well, remember, more lawsuits means more fees for him.
That's true. Wow, that's kind of a I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
But hopefully the city council is when they're.
Why should they bother? They get paid and they get power anyway.
Right, right. I mean, and the things that differentiate what empowers the elected officials versus the staff officials, and how that is contradictory to the real end goals. Because to have a decreased point in time count for the head count, the census, the annual census of the homeless, to have a decreased number. Looks good for the top executives. However, for our budget that gets applied for the county versus county allocation of funds, we lose lots of money. We lose 20%.
For the tourist business, it's wonderful we don't have those dirty homeless. We're having a reduction in homeless.
And for those who run the real estate investment trusts that are building the developments, and again, let's check out where those funds are coming from. And I have nothing against foreign capital investing in our great...
Iranian country. Capital? Russian capital?
Not mostly. But nonetheless...
Chinese capital?
A lot of it. But I love my Chinese investors. You know, back when I was in venture capital, I mean, they know...
Are you involved with any foreign government?
I'm not involved with any REITs. I am... Except maybe in some... trust fund stuff deep back, which I don't have access to. I am homeless.
There you go. You see, folks, it's all coming out now.
It's all a big racket. trust me, when I'm living in a tarp in the rain, it's not what
now,
I would
is
like
it,
to
do. Is any kind of, you? I think, I don't know if you mentioned it or somebody else at the last Huff meeting, there's been some concern about supposed vagrancy, fictitious... fictional vagrancy citations, where vagrancy, of course, is not a crime.
There have been there's videos. I think they're fake, where they walk up to people and ask how much.
They can do. They can lie all they want.
But other people are just trying to stir up crap and trying to make funny videos. I don't
actually heard from anybody in Santa Cruz that they've gotten a real vagrancy ticket.
Hell no, not. Not that.
How about a camping ordinance?
Oh, well, how about just trespassing for walking through and helping somebody that's having a psychological emergency, somebody that I have rapport with, somebody that I can move and that I was actively participating in moving that person who is very difficult to move, but I was actively moving that person and I get the ticket.
This happened to you recently?
For trespassing, just a couple of days ago. And the police officer was super polite and very...
A polite citation.
Yeah, I mean...
How sweet.
It's a complaint-driven department. If they receive a complaint, they kind of have to go out and make sure somebody gets pinged.
No, they don't.
Yeah, well, that's basically, I mean, but they don't...
They tell you that, but that's not true.
They don't do proactive policing, and that's because they don't have the time. They only have the time to respond to complaints, and I understand, it's like, this is...
Were you engaging in criminal behavior?
I was assisting somebody with...
That sounds pretty damn criminal to me, sir.
I know, but... It's something that should not be.
In Fremont, they've made that illegal, so therefore maybe here we need that too.
But that's a policy issue, and that's Fremont policy. We need it's not the police department's fault to be given policy and then to enact it. That is what they're supposed to do.
True, but it is their choice whether to respond to a complaint. That's the point.
If they're sent out by their watch commander to respond to a complaint, they need to respond to that complaint from a business owner that's got some heft.
If the business owner wishes to testify to that effect and sign something that says that, but that's not usually what happens.
No. Well, I mean, and that's why, I mean, I've got the wherewithal, and I've got the resources, and I've got all the documentation, and I've got...
And I've got the experience.
Yeah, look. The police department ought to look on whose name is on the past 6 years of TROs and injunction requests. You know, Desiree Quintero, our beloved sister who's fallen...
the one who died after 2019.
On the Ross camp. She was the name on the Ross camp. But look underneath it, Huff, and under Huff, Greg Bengtson will be there every single time.
And we don't blame you for that, Greg.
I'm happy to be there for that. And we've reached out to, the ACLU has certain... I know how to weave things through to find what hits the ACLU in the sweet spot where they want to respond. I know how to keep them out of the stuff that doesn't really matter to them
and
at the time.
The last time the ACLU made a response to something you said was...
Quite recently.
For example?
But I'm not going to say.
A secret response.
No, it's not. It's not a secret. It's just when we're talking back channel stuff.
Something not so secret where they've responded to you in the past?
That's a trick question.
No, it's a very straight question, actually. It's an attempt to determine the validity of what you're saying.
I'm going to show you a picture I just took of you wearing that tree as a hat.
I sometimes wear trees as hats. Are you disparaging my apparel?
Well, I'm not disparaging. I just got something to blackmail you with. And
I will give you a second chance. Do you wish to say any time that you've spoken to the ACLU and they've actually done, if they've actually done something?
Do you recognize
that? Is there any time that's ever happened?
Do you recognize this picture?
You're not answering my question.
A pine tree, a 40-foot-tall pine tree, are you not wearing it as a hat?
And he's effectively distracted me from my interrogation. You're going to have to talk to Greg about his answer. Greg is hypnotizing me with his moving phone. Anything I say before I break off in frustration?
Oh, you broke off in frustration a long time ago, but then you came back to us fully bearded and fully robed.
I'm still the same.
I know it's... Oh, he's still listening.
Of course.
Anyway,
so I'm going to assume that you have no evidence of your actually having, that you wish to present, that you've actually ever had any effect on the ACLU, which leads me to believe the ACLU is in its usual comatose state. Now, if you have anything
here's the thing. So the ACLU, they are...
Local ACLU.
The NorCal ACLU is... they have only limited bandwidth, and they have certain things that they are trying to...
Excuses for our local ACLU?
No, but we cannot look at them as the ambulance chaser of civil rights. The ACLU does have...
Responding to needs of homeless people who come to them, huh?
Sure. But
no, not sure. They don't do that.
How much bandwidth do they have? I want them to focus on the things...
They could make a statement. They could hold a press conference. They could do any number of things, but they usually don't.
We in Santa Cruz need to show up and show that there's any sort of... that it's not just one person complaining. We never show up in force. But it's been so long, and to get us in my community, the homeless community, if we need to show up, and if there's that...
But you were getting some inside channel, so you were getting some action from the ACLU. I think Steve here wants to say something.
Yeah, we do get that, but I'm not going to talk about back channel stuff. Back channel's back channel.
Whatever.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm back, Stephen Ross. This man gave me so much insight to the city workings that I got half the puzzle pieces put together already.
Well, get the rest of them puzzle pieces.
The rest are coming.
He will.
The rest are coming.
I'm counting on you.
This guy's one of those
people. I guarantee you within whatever time it takes, I'm going to get reimbursed for my car being removed from the streets because I was in a fire. It was parked on the street.
Let me know when that happens.
And they what will happen? $5,000, another check for $5,000 for the contents, and another check for $5,000.
Let me know when all those checks show up.
But he's accepted the forms, the yes, claims against the city and the county, and he's filled them out. So do you know how few people will even accept one of those forms and understand the process? He understands the process. He's a real estate investment person.
Well, I think it's good to do that. I think that's very good to do that. But don't get your hopes up.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm not going to hold my breath.
Good.
But they're going to need to take action because it's going to get escalated and escalated and escalated. I have a set of attorneys. I'll just tell you what they are. Downtown L.A. Law Firm, DTLA. DTLA, Downtown Law Firm.
Well, keep me advised about the progress of your lawsuit. I'd be curious.
They have
just filed it.
Even if it's on a back channel.
Back channel is back channel.
I just filed the suit in, what month is this? February?
I'm going to get this picture with the moon behind.
About February 1, February 2, I filed the suit. It's a multi-million-dollar lawsuit about my brother's death from carbon monoxide poisoning in his cheap, inexpensive rental property.
I tell you, that's a good point. I'm really interested mostly in what's going on the streets, so that's why I focus on that.
It's going to change.
That'll be
one
good.
One building at a time.
Would you mind?
Pretty slow changing. Yeah.
Artificially reaching out to the microphone just so I can get the moon behind your head with. And
it's going to cost you.
Human rights.
I'm sorry. My work is finished here.
You're the worst supermodel ever.
No, that's for sure.
You're the worst supermodel ever.
And we have been talking with
Greg Bengtson.
Thank you, Greg.
And good luck with the photo.
Thank you.
A career.
Hey, Steve. Any reports from your neck of the woods?
What's that?
Anything happening for Free Radio?
I don't know.
Anything happening that you know you've noticed on the streets in Santa Cruz you think we should know about?
Not really.
Yeah. No, that's not a bad thing.
Except the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
Say that again. What are you, some kind of communist?
The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
I'm afraid that's true.
We got billionaires in the White House.
And in the Democratic Party as well. And here comes Rovics again. Industrial disaster in Hamlet, North Carolina, and the failure of OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The name of the song, Sometimes I Walk the Aisles.
As we Americans spend so much of our tax money on wars and missiles, back at home, very little money or effort is spent on things like regulating industries for safety conditions. Even less in right-to-work states, where union organizing is especially challenging, and as a result, workers in those places are even more at the mercy of the bosses. On September 3rd, 1991, in the town of Hamlet, North Carolina, the predictable happened. Faulty and badly maintained equipment failed, an oil fire ignited, the emergency exits were blocked as usual by the manager who broke the law every day with no consequences, and 25 workers died, who might all have survived if the emergency exits hadn't been blocked. At the time that this fire killed these predominantly black women workers at this chicken processing plant, if every workplace were to be inspected by available safety inspectors in the state of North Carolina, the state had the resources to inspect each workplace once every 29 years. Sometimes I walk the aisles of the grocery store, and I think about a day some 20 years before, where this chicken came from south of the Mason-Dixon line, the Imperial Foods Factory in Hamlet, Carolina, the third day of September 1991, where for so many good people was the day the race was run. Sometimes I walk the aisles and I can hear the screams of those blasted by hot oil when old hose ruptured at the seams, of those blasted by hot oil when the fireball arose while more oil fueled the fire being blasted from the hose. More oil fueled the fire. The room filled up with smoke when those who weren't already dead then began to choke.
Sometimes I walk the aisles, I think about the padlocks on the fire doors, barred and blocked. The owner didn't want his workers stealing chickens out the back. It's a right-to-work state. They complain, they get the sack. So Tyson saved some money, and workers lost their lives. Once the fire was put out, the number dead was 25. Sometimes I walk the aisles and somehow feel ashamed. 11 years of operation, inspectors never came. Inspectors never came. Never came to look, to see if they did anything according to the book. Sometimes I walk the aisles and I wonder to myself, how many people died to put these nuggets on the shelf? Sometimes I walk the aisles.
And here are some thoughts from Drew of the Food Not Bombs meal last weekend in February, I think it was.
Here, hey Drew.
Been a very arousing day, very lovely day down here. It
hasn't been raining?
Oh, it's been raining. It's been raining, and it's just been really heartwarming to know that people have a place where they can go and get out of the elements, because they're not even allowed that in this city anymore. So I set up for the rain, as variable as the report was.
Right, which you mean you put up canopies for people?
We put up canopies. And now, starting around now, we're supposed to get some really strong winds, but that hasn't happened yet. But it's really, really nice. There's usually two canopies that which we serve from, and people stand online and then enjoy the park, the vicinity of the park. But today we have six canopies. We call that the pavilion. And people really have a lot of space just to be there, be with each other in close proximity, getting out of the rain, and people just getting along and loving the food. And yeah, right now, so as we turn out into the sunshine, so we're doing the clothes as well, where we didn't have room to do it before, or a dry place to do it before. So yeah, that's what's going on right now.
And you arrived around 10 this morning?
Pardon me?
What time did you arrive this morning?
I was here this morning by about 7 o'clock, because I looked at the Google weather, and there's an hourly report, and it provided for like a window of opportunity of an hour and a half. So for me to be able to set up without being in the rain, that was great. The window of opportunity I'm talking about is it wasn't going to start raining yet.
And what was that opportunity? What, 8 to 9 or something?
Yeah, it was something like 8 to 9, and it was right on time. As soon as I got that thing up, it started to really come down.
And how many hundreds of people were helping you?
Well, there was a few people helping. I didn't really have time to count.
did anyone show up specifically to help you, or did you?
Well,
just
the people that did show up, you know, that would be, you know, anxiously awaiting our arrival, came and ended up helping and making the process all the quicker.
But of course, the food didn't actually arrive until considerably later.
Well, we have a wonderful bakery donation that we get very, very early. Actually, the
stale bread.
No, Companion Bakery, and fresh bakery goods from the Verve. Wonderful, wonderful people. And then we have around 10:30, 11 o'clock, we get our first drop-off of coffee and the adorable French Cafe Bakery and Trader Joe's, all kinds of things like that.
Is this a meat day Sunday? Today is Sunday, the March 2nd, by the way.
Is it a meat day?
In other words, is there a non-vegan aspect to today?
No, there is actually. We, in addition to a full, wonderful, sumptuous vegan meal, Joe managed to cook a chicken dish every now and then when he's either doing that in his catering business or just has the ingredients. And so, yeah, the people that enjoy chicken are enjoying chicken.
And the key question, was today a chicken day? And do you have any left?
There is plenty left. There's plenty left, and today was a chicken day.
Wow, that's good news.
Ongoing.
Any other news from the street about hurt stuff you've heard in the last couple of hours?
Just that people are doing their very, very best to band, you know, to band together, stay together. People need togetherness. People need people to rely on people, you know, to rely on each other, excuse me. And, you know, a lot of that happens, you know, when people are soloing, they don't have a camp in which they have people that they can trust. You know, they can't go anywhere unless they take everything with them.
Now, we've heard that the camps on Coral Street have busted up because the police busted them, the Caltrans.
Yeah.
Has there been any reformation of camps that you know of?
I haven't seen that. I hear people, most people talk about the Pogonet. But I would say the vast majority of the people that I'm used to knowing over the last 4 years, they're like gypsies. You know, they're like roaming wherever they can. They're being randomly flushed. And it's, you know, it's really, really hard for them.
But nomads, gypsies.
Nomads meaning that they're set to wander. They're not allowed to settle. Yeah, it's got to be crazy making. And I really have to say, you know, our people are just not only survivalists, they're spiritual warriors, that they're able to maintain the best parts of their nature. You know, and it's just a pleasure and an honor to be able to contribute to them and feeding them and keeping them, you know, where they want to be.
We have rain coming up for the next few days, supposedly. A 10-day weather report. I guess it's for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Do you have any news of the emergency weather shelters being open?
You know, I don't, I have to say. The best thing I would, you know, could tell people is check in with the VA. You know, because the VA is doing a lot of cooking and sending food up to you know over to shelters, things like that. So every now and then I hear people talking about a warming center, but it's really, you know, more than I keep track of.
And then I'll ask you next week and see what you've heard then.
Okay.
After everybody's been soaked.
Well, very, very good. We had some wonderful. What was I trying to say? The camping gear we've been able to get this time of year. Sometimes it's a terrible competition to find it in the store. You know, that Big Five had been out, but we found other outlets in Watsonville that had been very, very friendly to us, giving us very, you know, really, really wonderful deductions. And that's great. It's all, you know, it's great.
Any reports of ill effects from the lithium fire?
I would say, excuse me one second here.
Sure. You're up. You're in your...
We have, I've only heard of a couple of people that lived in the, you know, in the Aptos area or closer.
Moss Landing.
Right? Yeah, closer to Moss Landing. But I'm really not hearing a whole lot. The thing that bothers me most of what I am hearing are the conflicting reports in the news, you know, where the Elkhorn Slough right up, you know, right there at Moss Landing is reading in heavy metals 100 to 1,000-fold. That was conducted by the San Jose University.
But heavy metals are good for you.
Heavy metals?
Great music, for one thing.
Well, sure. I mean, everything within healthy doses. It's not something I know too much about.
I don't know shit about it.
But evidently, yeah, you want to watch your cobalt and your manganese level and your lithium level and your nickel level. Okay, that's what they're finding, and it's kind of interesting because research reports that are happening that are representing agribusiness, because this is all those toxins flooded into what's, I never heard the term before, but it's flooded into what's called the country salad bowl, Salinas Valley, which is going to also include San Benito County, Hollister, that those, you know, they're saying, oh, that's, don't worry about it, all the levels are fine, you know, because the levels are up, but we don't know how much of that was already there. You know, I'm really not feeling like the right authorities are getting together and presenting a joint report that reflects the truth. So, yeah, that's kind
of truth much overrated, as our Führer will tell you.
Yes, really, really.
Now, at least if you go to Truth Social, you get the truth.
Okay.
You got a question for him?
Yeah, I need to sound if he's got one.
We are out unless Keith shows up with some more, I'm sorry to say. But, yeah, I know this doesn't help you today, but we gave about 25 away yesterday.
That's okay.
Okay.
You know me, I can
change. All right, love.
Yeah, I've heard regarding the fire that the fire had to do with inadequate storage, inadequate protection, bad building, storing them in the wrong buildings, and a massive intake in the number of lithium batteries that were being stored because of the increased wind and solar energy, which I think uses them, I'm told. All I know is what I read in the Mercury News, so you know that.
Right.
Anything else, any deaths recently that you know of outside?
Absolutely nothing I can think of. I know that within the last few weeks, one or two people reported to die of exposure. That was more like hearsay people. I never got a name.
Yeah, I think I heard that at least. It may have been the same thing. Is anybody taking the street spirit or street sheets that you've heard of?
We didn't have them out today because of the weather, but people have been taking them for sure.
The wind is beginning to kick up again.
Well, the wind, and we had the rain this morning.
Well, anything else you want to add that we haven't covered that you think we might want to mention to folks listening?
Please extend your support to Food Not Bombs. We need volunteers, people to serve, people to cook if they're interested. And just please accept us and the people that we are serving as part of our community. We only have one community, and everybody in it is worth attention and love and compassion and encouragement.
Some are worth a hell of a lot more than others. Financially speaking, of course.
Okay.
I know that People's Aid, have you heard anything about them recently?
Oh, no, I haven't.
And I understand the bread and Roses, is that what it is?
Yes, I'm familiar of the Bread and Roses. I'm not quite sure.
They used to serve near the Dragon's Head Bridge.
Yeah, I know that they're
pedestrian bridge.
They're active in some degree, but I'm just not sure what that is.
Well, I'm going to...
The work that they were doing was wonderful and always will be.
And so is yours.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I'll leave you having stolen 20 minutes or 10 minutes or however, 7 minutes actually of your time. I can see by the 11 minutes actually. Thank you. We've been talking with
Drew. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Drew.
Do you have now?
And here's a quicker update from Drew on Saturday the 8th, yesterday, if you're listening to this on Sunday the 9th.
Hello. Had a lot of people today here.
Right.
A lot of good, hungry people ready for some good food.
Was it meaty or non-meaty?
I think today we were strictly vegetarian.
Uh-huh.
But we saw some, two or three lovely people who had cooked in their kitchen for, to donate here. And as well as the food on top of our food. So we had plenty of food to go around. Mm-hmm. People were certainly happy with the good weather.
Yeah, it's sunny.
And, no one really had a whole lot to report as far as...
Vagrancy tickets on the street?
Well, yeah, as far as harassment.
Mm-hmm.
As far as harassment. It's kind of interesting, you know. I have kind of a theory, and a theory is really nothing more than a question. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to me, to see, all these different camps and all these people being swept. And it seems like they leave a token... eyesore here and there of people that are camping out on the street. When I say eyesore, I'm not talking about a personal value judgment. I'm talking about, the...
They strew trash all over as they break up the camp.
Well, what I'm basically saying, that there is, people that are anti-homeless, no matter how well-kept somebody tries to keep their tent and belongings, if they're on the sidewalk...
You're not calling our police anti-homeless.
They're considered an eyesore.
The police an eyesore, actually.
Well, yeah, we can definitely spend a long time in that direction. But what I'm saying is, it's like, while they are doing this clean up Santa Cruz harassment and sweep, it seems like they leave certain people that are out in the open so they can, it almost campaigns, for their cause, because
they do need the work,
Drew.
Yeah, yeah. But do you get what I'm saying?
I think I do, unfortunately. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like it billboards their values, you know, so people are going, you know, so there'll be people going, when are you going to do something about that? While they're doing it, and while they're doing it most, you know, inhumanely.
Surely Fred Keeley would not allow that to happen.
Socially. But anyway, like I said, that's just a theory. And
are donations rising or falling generally for Food Not Bomb?
Staying the same. I would say that as the weather gets better, we tend to get more. You know, as we get into the spring season, people just get kind of energetic. People are doing their spring cleaning. People will be bringing all kinds of things from their pantry. People will be cooking. And we're heading into the season where we tend to see more. And then over the summer, it kind of plateaus. And then, you know, when we start getting more towards the cold weather, people start thinking about that, too. And, you know, those with warm hearts think about cold weather.
Any reports of deleterious effects for folks outside from the fire in the Moss Landing area of the lithium storage plant?
So far, it's somewhat of a mystery of what's going on. You know, that it's amazing how oblivious some people are to the incident, you know, at that, you know. I mean, we're talking about a fire that burned for 3 days, shut down a major highway for 3 days, evacuated 1,500 people from Moss Landing. And there are, I had never heard this term before, but Salinas Valley is considered the salad bowl of the country. Okay. And they're saying within a 20-30 mile radius of the fire that New Leaf, from what I understand, has been very responsible in pushing those who are doing the tests, the so-called reliable tests, mm-hmm. to come forth with something, you know, conclusionary. Mm-hmm. And I haven't heard this from New Leaf, but someone said that New Leaf made a statement that chard, kale are two very, very big no-nos right now, and artichokes. So I don't know what that's going to do to Castroville.
And last, and probably not least, is a poem from Bert Glick, Santa Cruz local.
With Bert Glick, it's March 2nd, 2025, and we're in the afternoon at People's Coffee. Bert, you have a poem that you're about to read, if I'm correct.
Lower East Side. Someone convulsing near 10th Street and Avenue B to the beat of bongos and free-flowing fire hydrants. Someone else telling East Jesus everyone should spend 48 hours in Bellevue and jail just to get a taste. I've been there and back, says East Jesus. I don't get involved now. I look like a hippie. So what else is new? News Digest. A junkie just raced down 6 flights of railroad flats in record time, a TV in his arms. By the by, I learned how to play chess right around there in Tompkins Square. You have to submerge your ego to learn the game. You lose all the time for a long time. Part of the peripheral mosaic, a peace march uptown. Ungodly how we kill our own on a scale unknown in nature, except for species of insects. Nonetheless, we have to stamp out communist aggression in the bud, or it will surely spread. so said, our pantheon of presidents, one after the other. I will be clubbed and gassed down the road protesting, but that's neither here nor there. Now we are tottering. 2025 style.
And comes now another David Rovics number. It's discussion of gun violence in America and the death of his friend Eric Mark in San Francisco, his dear friend. Song for Eric Mark.
Tens of thousands of people are killed every year in the USA by gun violence. In the wee hours of May 1st, 1993, one of those killed in the USA was named Eric Mark. He was shot by a young man wielding a shotgun while standing on the sidewalk on the corner of 23rd and Shotwell Streets in San Francisco's Mission District. Only a few years earlier, Eric had gotten a degree in mechanical engineering at UC Berkeley and a good job as a mechanical engineer for the city of Berkeley upon graduating. But he quit that job and moved to San Francisco to become a cab driver because he wanted to see the world. His fellow cab drivers all wondered if he was working at the time he was killed. He wasn't. He was keeping an eye out for cops while me and a couple other folks wrote revolutionary slogans on a three-story abandoned building of some kind. Turned out the cops weren't so much the problem as the gang war that was going on, we learned later.
Every time I see that street, I think of you. And I think of the mornings, your long red hair. You're rolling out of bed, though you'd rather stay right there. But your housemates are up, and there's so much to do. Every time I see that street, I think of you. And I think of the afternoons, lost together in thought. Our long walks in the park, all the answers we sought. With a mind and a heart of the wondrous few. And every time I see that street, I think of you. And I think of the evening, all the stories you told. Out driving your cab, barely 20 years old, but with such ancient eyes, oh, the wisdom you knew. And every time I see that street, I think of you. And I remember that night, the tequila we drank, laughing for hours with a world to thank. And you told me you loved me, and I said, Eric, I love you too. And every time I see that street, I think of you. Determined to wander till the darkness was gone. San Francisco at night and the warm summer breeze, or walking back alleys just as free as you please. And I think of those poor boys who drove up to say, give us your money, and they blew you with one pull of a trigger. Your sweet life was through. And every time I see that street, I think of you.
So coming up next are two flashbacks to 1996, February of 1996. February 2nd and February 5th. And most of them are at various points a little bit hard to hear because the recording is slightly distorted almost throughout, but I think it's audible, intelligible. At some points you may want to skip ahead if it seems particularly hard to hear. But it's, I think it's an interesting historical record of what was going on in those days. We have many people I don't remember. One fellow named Dean talking about not just folks, but actual creatures who are non-human being homeless. And that, how do we deal with them? We talk about the bench removal that happened on Pacific Avenue after the earthquake. Bob LaMonica pushes for a pedestrian mall. In-studio guest, Dragon's Heart, Daniel Hopkins, talks about his upcoming appeal, and then he later talks about his appeal in the next section of the Community House Project, which swept away an encampment of 150 people, the Save Our Shelters encampment that was back of the, I guess what is now the Funding Matters or Housing Matters, as they call themselves, complex at 115 Coral Street. You'll get to hear Barbara Riverwoman's letter to Scott Kennedy. Barbara Riverwoman was an activist. Scott Kennedy was a council member who was instrumental in destroying the campground that had been promised by the campers to the citizens of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, who had purchased the property, I think, originally and intended it. They had promised it until they would begin to build the so-called Community House Project, which was a series of trailers that existed for about 15 or 20 years before it was finally torn down. Recent years, actually. Chris Brozda, who tries to remain anonymous, but his voice is recognizable, talks about the importance of maintaining the criminalization of drug dealing, even if you want to decriminalize drugs. I talk about my urging that people recognize this was a deal made by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless to allow people to camp on their property until such time as construction actually began with the so-called Community House Project, and therefore to jump the fence and pitch your tents. And Carl Brun talks about community television and its beginnings and its policy of leaving its recyclables out on Thursday night for folks to pick up. I wonder if they're still doing that with the more reactionary management of community TV that happened in later years. The February 5th show, and I've been talking about the February 2nd, 96 show, has a lot of discussion about the county curfew that was being proposed for people under 18. Robbie Berlin is a studio guest, in-studio guest, who is going to trial for medical marijuana and using the necessity defense to defend himself, saying that he had to do it. He was indeed illegal, but he, if you found him illegal, you would still have to find he had a greater necessity to use it to protect his health. You'll get some more dialogue from Bob LaMonica, Phil Free. Becky Johnson comes on in an early appearance. She discusses Citizens Committee for the Homeless's faults and what's going on with them in terms of how they're working with the city to essentially throw out the campers and build their own project, somewhat belying their homeless name, although they would no doubt say they were doing it for a greater pathway to housing for the homeless. I talk about the Union Grove sidewalk debate on whether one person walks a difference or makes a difference. This is outside the Union Grove Music, where folks would sit on the berm of the parking lot and then get hassled by police for doing so. And that pretty much winds it up for the flashbacks. I remind you, don't listen to the numbers, or listen to them, but don't expect to get any answers if you call them. The one exception, as ever, is the Huff line, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-4833, though I am, as I think I mentioned earlier in the show, perhaps I didn't, that I'm getting a cell, the line is being turned over from a landline to a cell phone, so I'll be able to answer it more readily if I've got this thing on, which won't always be the case. If you have stuff you want to report about what's going on the streets for me to mention on the show, give me a call and we'll talk about it. And that really is about all I've got to say tonight. To me, it's night. For you, it's, if you're listening to this on the Sunday the 9th, it's morning or early afternoon. So don't just listen. Go out there. Use your eyes, your voice, your physical presence to do something that's real and defends the rights of your own rights and the rights of those around you in Santa Cruz. Thanks for listening.